Greetings and welcome to the NASCAR and NBC podcast. I'm your host, Nate Ryan. Our guest this week is Roger Penske, who truly needs no introduction. If there is a name that transcends American auto racing, it's Penske. You don't need to be an ardent disciple of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to know that Roger Penske is synonymous with the world's greatest racetrack. His teams have a record 16 victories in the Indianapolis 500, most recently last year with Juan Pablo Montoya. But this year is especially significant for Roger Penske at Indianapolis. Sunday will mark the 100th running of the Indy 500, and it coincides with Team Penske's 50th year of existence. There aren't many racing teams that can say they've been around a half century, much less enjoyed the kind of success that Roger Penske's cars have. And Roger Penske's history stretches back even further than that at Indy. He attended his first Indy 500 as a 14-year-old in 1951, and he has missed only a handful in the 55 years since then. This one will be particularly special because he gets to drive the Chevrolet Camaro pace car for the 100th running of the Indy 500. So we'll touch on that, including the fact that he needed to take a physical to be in the car that is going to lead the field to green on Sunday. This is amusing because not everyone knows that Roger Penske was a highly decorated race car driver in his day who won in NASCAR. So I asked him about his racing career, which drivers he might have resembled in terms of his driving style. And I also took the opportunity to ask if he had many laps in his race cars, if he'd ever ventured onto the brickyard in one of his own race cars, whether in a practice or a test. We touched on the current state of his racing teams in IndyCar and NASCAR, as well as what the future holds for both series and racing in general. With the appeal of the automobile for America's digitally obsessed youth somewhat in question, I asked him if there are challenges to keeping auto racing relevant in the future. There are few who are as well known for being as forward-thinking in racing as Roger Penske is, so I think you'll want to hear his answer on that one. As always, we appreciate you listening. Please leave a rating or review on iTunes or send me feedback on Twitter. That's at Nate Ryan. Feedback about the show, whether it's guest suggestions or format ideas, I'm always interested. So without further ado, here's our conversation with Roger Penske. Thanks so much for being here, Roger. I want to start with the obvious. Obviously, this is a very magical month for Indianapolis Motor Speedway in particular, because it's the 100th running of this majestic race that you've been so much a part of. Already been announced as a sellout, so I know roughly 250,000 people will be there next week. But what's the atmosphere like today, about 12 days out from the green flag? Can you already sense that things are different compared to your past trips to Indy?
There's more people interested in attending the race because it's the 100th, obviously. For us, it's our 50th year in racing, so it's all very special to us. As you know, this race has been key for me for a number of years, and also, you know, with four great drivers, we're focusing on trying to get our 17th win, but there's a lot of buzz here, and they've done a great job on the track. The new seating along the front straightaway and the things they've done here, they continue to upgrade it. So, you know, it is a great place to race once a year.
Your first trip to Indianapolis, I saw you say this week, Roger, was in 1951 as a 14-year-old. Is that right?
Yeah, I came here in 51 with my dad to see the race. Lee Vollard won it that year, and I guess the bug bit me. Or I bit the bug, I'm not sure what you say. I wanted to come back here either as a driver, probably first, but then as my business interest maybe got in the way, and I became a car owner, which obviously has turned out to be, you know, a great thing for our company, building our brand. And I'd say Indianapolis, these wins and the notoriety we got here have really been the foundation for a lot of our success.
Yeah, I'd say it's worked out very well for you. I was going to ask how many Indy 500s you've attended, but it probably would be easier just to ask you how many you have missed since 1951. Have you missed any races since that time as a 14-year-old?
Well, I think that, you know, I missed the ones when we decided not to run the race 95 through 2000. and I was here every race after that, other than those 5 years. So, you know, I've had a long history here. I've seen a lot of things change. I was talking to someone today about how they used to line up on May 1st on 16th Street, and there was one guy that was always the first guy in line. And, of course, they won't let him park on the streets anymore here, but, you know, the tradition, the history, and the following of the race, it's amazing. Every place you go, they talk about it.
That first race, I heard you say this week that you sat in a race show car. Is that right? Was that what you did that time?
Yeah, it was amazing. My dad worked for a company that was sold International Nickel products, and I guess they were a lap sponsor. And they had a luncheon that we were late to get to. We got to the house, and everybody had gone to the track, and there was a show car sitting there, and I got to sit in the car with the helmet on. So that was really amazing to think about. We have show cars today, but even, you know, back in 51, they had cars from the previous race. You see them in the hotels here. You see them at the airport. So it's kind of deja vu.
Yeah. We've heard from so many people about what their first trips to Indy were like, whether it, you know, Tony Stewart riding in the luggage rack of a bus with his dad going down there. What was it like for you making those pilgrimages early? Was it you and your father just driving there in on race morning from Shaker Heights, Ohio, or how would that trip go?
Yeah, we drove the night before. We stayed along the way and drove from Cleveland and came here, you know, didn't have very good seats. They were, you know, off the fourth turn, and you know, you could hardly see the cars go by in those days, but, you know, I was a, you know, a real fan of racing. I'd gone to a number of races, flat track races around the Cleveland area, Canton and Akron and places like that, to see the midget drivers. Some of the same people in those days drove midgets were the ones that were, you know, competing here, but, you know, you'll never forget that first time you walked into the speedway to see the size of it and understand the bricks and all the things that took place, and then to become here in 69, you know, as a car owner and try to, you know, work your way up the ladder to be, you know, competitive, and watching guys like Foyt and some of these big teams, Wilkie and the guys that were, you know, so dominant in those early years when we were here, and the Unsers and Johnny Lightning and Parnelli Jones and Val Melitich. These are guys that, you know, you just looked up to. You were glad to be in the same garage area with them.
Right. And you mentioned, Roger, obviously a special year for you. Indianapolis's 100th Indy 500 is the 50th year for Team Penske. And I know that also it's the 50th anniversary for the 2017 Camaro, which you're going to be behind the wheel as for the pace car driver for the race. I know you've been joking about maybe picking up an advantage from your team, from maybe tapping the brakes on the pace laps. What's it been like to be behind the wheel of that car and take some laps around the brickyard?
Well, it's a tremendous car. It's got a 455 horsepower engine. It's a special SS Camaro that was built and came off the assembly line. And the nice thing is it's a car that you can buy on the street and, you know, hit some laps on the track. And ironic, today I had to go take my physical, I guess, before you can drive on this racetrack, you have a physical. So the good news is I passed my physical, so I guess I'll now be able to drive on race day. So I guess you never know.
You weren't nervous at all about taking that physical, I suspect.
Say that again?
You weren't nervous at all about taking that physical, I suspect, right?
No. You never know. You know, you never know. But it was interesting to go to the infield. I've been to the infield hospital before for the wrong reasons, but I went there today to, you know, get my physical so I could be, you know, qualified to drive the pace car.
Have you ever taken laps at speed in one of your race cars at Indy just for fun?
No, I never have. No, I've just really left the speedway running to the drivers, and I think you'd like to do that, but it just doesn't work out with the practice and the qualifications you have to have. It would be complicated. Anything that takes away from, you know, the mission of winning this race and having me drive a car around, I don't think makes sense. And I've never done it when we've had a test day either. But I've been around the track a number of times in passenger cars with the guys, and so I have a pretty good feel of the track, but never at speed.
Okay. Did you pick up anything during your laps in the Camaro the other day for this
well,
week?
I know that when you drive close to the wall, you can feel it. I can imagine these guys when they brush it at 230. I was probably going 100, and I was glad you really start to realize the skill sets of all these drivers from the early days to to where they are today with the downforce and how fast they can go and still keep the car on the track. It's a tremendous feeling, I'm sure, for them. And it's a skill group that not everybody can qualify for, but this year's race, they've got some great drivers, great competition, and we're gonna be out for another win.
I want to ask you a little about your driving career, Roger. I know you've been asked about this again, just to fill in the listeners. You were the SECCA 1961 Driver of the Year by Sports Illustrated, 1962 Driver of the Year by the New York Times, and then you went in the dealership business. You retired from race car driving in 1965. I know everybody asks, do you miss it? I know Will Power asked you about that this past week, but I'll try to frame it in a different way. When was the last time you were in any race car? It sounds like never at Indy, but have you ever just gotten in a race car just for fun, not necessarily in competition? Have you done it since 1965?
Well, I had a chance to drive a Viper for Dodge. They had a small event out in Utah at Miller Motorsports Park, and I drove a Viper, a competition Viper, a few laps out there, but that's really been the last time I've been in a car. Talked about driving, one of the NASCAR cars, but it never worked out for me. I pretty much the day I hung my hat up, I hung it up and really focused on on business.
Yeah. Did you ever get a chance, maybe, or give thought to maybe a one-off of maybe a stint in a endurance race, sports cars, or anything like that?
Well, the one thing that would come close to doing that was the Mela Miglia. I've done the Mela Miglia four times. Mm-hmm. In a gullwing Mercedes, and that's pretty high speed stuff in a car that was built in 1955, so that's about as close as I've gotten to be on the track.
Yeah, and I was going back through the records, Roger, and did you win a NASCAR race in 1963? Do I have that correct?
Yeah, I won the race at Riverside with a Pontiac. I drove for Ray Nichols, Parnelli Jones, Gurney, all those guys were in that race. I almost won the race a couple months earlier at the Indianapolis Raceway Park. Was leading with about 10 laps to go and lost the rear end, and then went out and won the race at Riverside. And I remember, it was a NASCAR race, and when I came back, they didn't want to let me in the speedway because I had driven a NASCAR car.
Times have changed from that perspective, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. but no regrets, no second thoughts after you came into Riverside and whipped the competition or could beat them at Indianapolis Raceway Park. Once you went in the team ownership in 65, that was it.
Well, it was, a commitment I had to make to General Motors to become a Chevrolet dealer, and also, my dad had loaned me some money that he didn't have much at all, and I certainly didn't want to squander that away, so I had to focus on, the car business, and as I did, we were able to grow our business, and obviously today was, the great team of people we have given us a tremendous amount of success.
One more question for you on your driving days. Just curious, what kind of driver would Roger Penske have been, do you think, if you would have stayed in it? I'm not asking to project your results, but more of your race car style. Were you a Rick Mears, a Brad Keselowski, a Mark Donohue, Joey Logano, Bobby Unser, Danny Sullivan, Rusty Wallace? What kind of driver was Roger Penske, and who do you think he might have resembled if you would have stayed in it?
Well, I'd have knocked a couple guys off the track that got in my guy's way, I would have tell you that. Mark, I don't know. I certainly wasn't as cool as Mears. I guess I always wanted to have the best car and have an unfair advantage. So, I tried to be as competitive as I can. Good. And, I finished races. If you look at my finishing record, it was pretty good. I took care of the equipment. And I don't know. It's hard to say, who would have been. Al Unser Sr. was a driver that, really could finish races day in and day out and deliver the mail into the winner's circle. But I might have to say I'm a split between Logano and Keselowski. How's that? That'll make everybody feel good.
That'll make you feel younger than I, too, I suppose, if you go that
right,
way.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you have had the sponsor business side down pat? I know it probably wasn't nearly as a big a part of the driving spectrum as it was in the 60s as it is now, but I would suspect that you would have grown right into that role as racing became so sponsor-oriented over the years.
Well, I remember my first sponsor was DuPont. They had a product called Xerox and Telar, and I remember I had to tape it over because in SCCA, as a gentleman's sport, didn't want to have a sponsor, and I'd have the tape blow off about the second lap. So we needed sponsorship early on in order to be able to survive. I remember that one of the first sponsors I had was $300 a race.
Whatever it took to get by, I'm sure you had it covered. Speaking of sponsorship, we took a tour of your palatial Team Penske facility in Mooresville last week, Roger, and it was terrific. We really got some great inside looks into what's going on up there. Tim Sindrick was on this podcast a week ago, and he told me that it had been your plan really in the works since 2004, since really a few years before you moved the NASCAR side into that shop, to have your IndyCar and NASCAR teams under one roof. Looking backward now, 12 years later, with IndyCar and NASCAR championships in the past 4 years and having perennial title contenders on both sides, did this plan turn out the way you thought? I know it might have taken a little bit longer than you might have anticipated, but the last few years, has it really been a vindication for you that this was the right move?
Well, I think people would call us Penske Racing North and Penske Racing South, and we wanted to be one company, number one, and I think the ability with the size of organization we needed in NASCAR, and with Tim, committing to go to Charlotte and bring the IndyCar team there and take over the responsibility, it was a slam dunk. We hit the building. We spent probably a year laying it out to be sure that every piece of it was going to be functional, and we'd have the ability to grow, and we've been able to do that with the IndyCar. We had the Porsche program stationed there when we ran the long-distance races, but I think the ability to move our people from one discipline to another has been important. The engineering flow between the different disciplines continues to be important, and more important is, I think, when you showcase to a sponsor, they can see the cross-pollination between the different disciplines, and it's helped us commercially. We use that location for many meetings by our key sponsors, people who were trying to support the community and give back. We've had many events there which have paid off, so I'd have to say, you look at the record book, since we moved there, number of races we won, both in IndyCar and also in NASCAR, it's a pretty impressive record, so I'd have to say it was the right move.
Right, and Tim happened to mention, Roger, that there's still about 90,000 square foot of undeveloped space there. Any more teams in your future? It sounds like a return to sports cars might not be out of the realm of possibility in the near future.
Well, I'd say sports cars would be something we've always liked it. I think that with the great road racers we have on the IndyCar side, if we can ever get a program together and be able to utilize our guys, they love it. Their racers are racers. They'd run every weekend if they could. When you think about the NASCAR boys and what we have here, and I think we certainly have the capacity. We have the knowledge, and if it's a North American opportunity, we'd certainly take a look at it. And if it could ever get us to Le Mans, that would be probably one of the last mountains we'd like to climb.
Wow. And if you were able to do it, it sounds like we could see a Montoya, Keselowski, Logano, willpower type special entry at, say, a Rolex or a Sebring. Would that be a possibility?
That would be, we'd love to have a couple of cars down there and have all our guys at the wheel. We certainly have the talent, and it's interesting. They'd do anything. I remember when Kurt Busch drove for us when the Rolex at one point he ran. He loved it. It was a big day. Gordon's run down there. Jimmy Johnson has. I think it's those races are fun. And to me, if we could put something together, it would be something we certainly would like to take a hard look at.
While we were getting a tour of the Mooresville shop, Roger, Brad Keselowski took us through the gym, and he pointed out all those quotes that you have along the walls there. And he pointed out, obviously, your favorite, effort equals results, courtesy of Julius Penske. I know that I've heard that phrase around your team a lot, but I don't know if I know the complete origins. I'm sure you've been asked this 100 times, but where did you first hear your father saying that? What was it in relation to, and why has it meant so much to you as a mantra through your life?
Well, I think, it was early on. He told me if you work hard, you'll get the results. And, you know, we kind of coined the phrase effort equals results, and it certainly paid off. You're not lucky. I think the people who work hard, train, and are focused and do their job and go the extra mile, you'll get results. And, it was something that we talked about. We got a coin that says effort equals results that we've always had with us. And to me, it goes back a long, long time. And when you think about those two words, it's possibly the most important thing. If you put the right time and effort in, you're gonna have a victory. You're gonna have results.
Right. Another saying on those walls, Roger, is anything you want, you can get it if you work at it. And that's attributed to Roger S. Penske. It's a rather simple way of looking at things, but what's the best example of that maybe in your professional career, that if you want something, you can get it if you work at it? Is there anything that you've ever had or one of your employees ask you, like, hey, why does that make sense? And you point to this and say, here's why it made sense.
Well, I think, you take the when we went to Indianapolis in 94 and we said, we'd seen the Buicks and these guys with these pushrod engines. I said, look, we can do it better and we can win the race. And I think the ability to partner with Mercedes and put that plan together and lead every lap, I think, but two and win the race was a perfect example of that. And I think in business, even though you have downturns in the cycle, we've been able to really work through those because of the commitment by our people. And I think that's probably the most important thing. And I think that in our country, we're very fortunate to be able to have the opportunities to do things that you strive for. And it's someone's trying to, jump the highest with a high jump or swim the fastest lap. These are all things that people want to do. And I guess we're built that way here in this country. And we've been given opportunities that I think some people have not taken advantage of that. I think that we're on a stage every day in business and on the racetrack that it takes going faster the next day or the next week or the next year, whether it's your quarterly earnings or whether it's your speed at Indianapolis, you got to be better. And if you want it, you can get it. So to me, that's very important.
Is it just as simple as looking at everything in life as a challenge that can be met and overcome and solved?
Well, I think, some of it's physically, some of it's mentally, and certainly it's health when you look at families and, that have to deal with things that, you shut your eyes because it's so tough. But I think that it's in many different ways, you have to be able to take on the challenges and beat them. And it's commitment, I guess, at the end of the day. It's all about commitment.
Right. In terms of being an inspiration and saying things like that get people going, Roger, Mark Royce, the Vice President of Product Development for General Motors, says that meeting you at Indy in the early 70s, he said this earlier this week when you guys did the pace car unveil, he said it changed his life, and meeting you made him want to work on cars as an engineer. What's it mean to hear things like that, that your brand name I know the brand means so much to you, that it has that kind of resonance, that it's meant that much to somebody who's that influential at a place like GM or anywhere, and that your name has been synonymous with Indy for that long? I mean, that's going back 40 plus years, and it's only been enhanced by 16 Indy 500 wins. What do you ever stop and think about, like, as much as the Indy 500, the 100th running, that's an icon, but like that your name is so much a part of the fabric of what this race is?
One of the highest jobs at GM. He's been very instrumental in supporting the community in Detroit. There's nobody who does more for the city. Certainly his commitment to Elmore and Chevy for the Chevy engine and what he's done from a performance standpoint. But, you know, taking the company, you know, out of bankruptcy and leading it as it is today is important. And I'm just glad that he puts me in a category that he feels that, you know, I've given him some inspiration, you know, along the way. I mean, he and I are good friends. We work each day in maybe in a different office, but I think we have the same goals, and that's to be the best and take care of our people and understand that you give a little bit back and you'll be fine.
I know that you always are looking ahead, so I want to end that way, Roger, and just look ahead on a few questions. The first would be, in my former life as a USA Today sports writer, I talked to you at Indy 8 years ago, right after the merger that brought IndyCar into unification. And at that point, you said that it wasn't going to be a rocket ride, that it was going to take a little while for Indy to reclaim some of its past glory, given the 14-year civil war that it had gone through. 8 years later, where do you think the state of IndyCar is in 2016? Is it much further beyond where it was in 2008? Would you like to see it be further along, or does it? I mean, where do you think the trajectory is 8 years out?
Well, I think that you know, as we came back together, and Tony George realized, and we realized that we were better together than apart. That the sport has made you know, a lot of progress. I think the racing product on the racetrack is excellent. You know, the quality of the teams that we see out here and we see at the track every day is much better than it's been. I think the one thing we need is to have a schedule which is consistent, so we develop date equity so people can count on coming to that weekend of that race across the country. And I think that Mark Miles is a breath of fresh air from the standpoint of, you know, as a leader, you know, of the series, and, you know, obviously from the Holman Company. I feel good about it. I think they've done one thing that's been good. They've kept the cost down. When you think about, we race in the biggest race in the world, and we run a full season, and someone can come in here and probably for $5 million can have a car and a driver and, you know, compete up front. That's different than $350 million, which you have to have at Formula One. And I think at the end of the day, you know, costs are going to be key with sponsorship, you know, tough to get. But I think safety probably is the most important thing that's come out of the last 7 or 8 years, is the level of safety, not only at the tracks with the soft walls, but also, you know, all the different series have really focused on the driver and the car. And I'd say that part of it, we're way ahead than where we were when we were not together. And I think that commitment by the car owners and some of the sanctioning bodies have lifted this sport to the next level.
Safety, costs, competition certainly are priorities in NASCAR as well, Roger. What do you think the state of NASCAR is in 2016, and what needs to happen there to keep moving forward?
Well, I think that, you know, NASCAR has a unique product. It amazes me when people said that, you know, they're not getting the attendance. And I say to them, I ran the Super Bowl in 2006, and we were clapping our hands above our head when we had 75,000 people. And you could say NASCAR has a Super Bowl every weekend wherever they go. I think we built a lot of seats. Maybe over the last 10 years, maybe because of the financial crisis and just people today, with a tighter economy and costs going up, they just can't come to two different races each year. But I would say, you know, the interest in the sport is still strong. We're able to acquire sponsors probably better today than we could the last 3 or 4 years. They want more for less, obviously, which is understandable. I think the racing product or the chase has made a huge difference in the intensity in the garage area. And certainly the interest as we get to the end of the season. The new road package this year is also, you know, been a curveball because it's a new setup. I think that, you know, there's no question that Gibbs right now has, with the four drivers, they have four good drivers can win on any day, is, you know, really leading at the moment. But I feel good, you know, where we are with Brad and certainly with Joey. He didn't want to race yet, but it's been competitive. And then Blaney has come along. I think Blaney and young Elliott are two of the young stars coming along, which will see running there for a long time. So I'm the guy with the glass half full. I feel good about where we're going. You know, there's always things you don't like, but I keep those in my back pocket, and I think at the end of the day, if we can keep costs down and we don't change the rules every day, I think the Race Team Alliance has been a big step in the communication. I think you'd have to say that probably is, one of the major things that's happened in the last 12 months is there's a definite dialogue, positive and honest dialogue between the competitors and the sanctioning body, and I think that's only proved to be beneficial as we go forward.
Last one for you, Roger. You mentioned Ryan Blaney, Chase Elliott, obviously up-and-coming stars from the next generation, from the millennial generation. The state of auto racing in general, I hear sometimes hand-wringing about the fact that the automobile might not be as important to kids these days, that they aren't as interested in getting their driver's license. I'm sure as somebody who's so immersed in the auto industry, you hear these things too. What do you think auto racing needs to do to maintain its relevance going forward? I mean, if you would have the institutional knowledge that you have and the ability to anticipate where things are going, does auto racing need to take steps to address things like getting kids interested in cars, or are those things that take care of themselves? What do you think that just the sport needs to do in general just to ensure that Memorial Day weekend is always a tradition that screams auto racing?
Well, let me say this. You know, we hear that a lot, but, you know, we've done some research and we think kids still want to have a car. I know that maybe it's not the first thing they do when they're 16 years old, but mobility is important. Certainly we have the disruptors with Uber and Lyft and people like that, but I think that as long as people can go fast, some of us want to go faster, and I think that we use it as a customer entertainment medium from a business perspective, and also to build a brand, so there's always going to be someone that has the notoriety of going fast, and I think that's really the backbone of racing. And when you think about it as a spectator sport, it's clean. I mean, it's done on the short tracks, around the country. I don't know how many races there are each weekend, but, it's an entry-level sport that it's not for everybody. It never has been, but I think there will always be a pipeline of young people who have an interest to race. And with these big stadiums that have been built, when you think about the $400 million that has been invested by the folks at Daytona, they didn't do that because they didn't look at the future. And they're making a lot of these tracks, into events, special places, not just as a place to sit and watch cars go around. There's more entertainment, and I think getting closer to the drivers with the telematics today and being able to drive in the seat, listen to the pit stops, there's a lot of things that will, I think, keep the interest. But maybe the races will be shorter. They'll have multiple races on a weekend, which will hold the spectators' interest longer. But I'm as I say, positive that racing, at least my lifetime, won't change too much.
All right. Well, certainly Daytona was full in February. Indianapolis will be full next week, and we'll be watching to see how your cars do, as always, in this race. Roger, thanks so much for giving me so much of your time. Really appreciate your being generous with that, and good luck next week.
All right, Nate. Thanks. All the best. It was fun. Thank you.
Take care. Our thanks to Roger Penske for joining us on the NASCAR on NBC podcast. Many thanks as well to Penske Vice President Jonathan Gibson. Jonathan has been a big supporter of this podcast since its origin, and he went to great lengths to make this episode happen. Roger Penske is a multinational business mogul who could wake up every day of the week in a different country if he so chose. His time is very precious, but Jonathan managed to carve out 30 minutes on his schedule, and we are grateful. Also appreciate the work of Team Penske IndyCar PR manager Sean Sabara, who helped work us onto Roger Penske's schedule on a rainy afternoon at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. As mentioned, Team Penske has been very helpful in supplying us with guests. Joey Logano was our first driver guest on the podcast. We had Team President Tim Sindrick a couple of weeks ago. And stay tuned soon for Brad Keselowski. We are lining up the 2012 Sprint Cup champion to join us next month. Thanks as well to Tess Quinlan for producing the podcast. This episode and all of the rest are available on Stitcher, thanks to Tess. You also can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes for automatic downloads of new episodes. Thanks again for listening to the NASCAR NBC podcast. Hope you enjoyed it.